Joining us now is the author of this book, The Street Economist. Subtitle is 15 Economic Lessons Every Citizen Should Know. Axel Kaiser is the author who is joining us now. And he has, he's an internationally known writer and economist. He is involved with many different, in Central and South America. He's a Chilean-German lawyer. He's also a senior fellow at the Atlas Center for Latin America, based in Miami, a visiting scholar at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, besides being a best-selling author, and well-respected in terms of his ability to explain things. And that's the key thing. If you really understand something, you can simplify it for people. And that's what he does. He's got 15 simple examples. It's not a lot of economic analysis and not a lot of jargon. It's just in everyday street terms. And it's been very successful in terms of getting people to understand what is happening. And when you combine an explanation of free market economics with a hyperinflation seeing in Argentina, that starts to move things. And so last time he was on, we talked about Javier Milei. In Argentina, a surprise, strong showing by him in the first election as a libertarian economist. He came in first place. And since we spoke, there's now been another election. And I wanted to get Axel Kaiser's comments about that because he knows Javier Milei, who is in Argentina. Again, Axel is in Chile. So thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, since we last talked, as I said, we've had this election and Javier Milei came in second. I was surprised to see that the guy who is the socialist candidate, who is now the finance minister, edged him out in first place. But there's now going to be a runoff between the two of them. Tell us a little bit about that and how you see this. Why did that happen?
Well, actually, you know, you have a problem in Argentina that it's called Peronism. Mm-hmm. Peronism, it's a religion. It was developed by Juan Domingo Perón, a general who ruled in the country for many years. And he was a fascist, basically, mm-hmm. a collectivist, a statist, not a communist, but he didn't believe in free markets. He didn't believe in economic freedom. He believed in these sort of corporate arrangements and that the state had to basically control people's lives and the economic system and give everyone benefits and social rights and things like that. And this became, over the decades in Argentina, sort of, you know, religion in the country. It's like if you would say about, maybe we would talk about Saudi Arabia or any of these Muslim countries, and you could not imagine them without being Muslims, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so, to some extent, Peronism became part of Argentina's identity. And it's the mythology that gives Argentinians, a large part of the population in Argentina, sense of, you know, of belonging and also meaning and all of that. It's a very
connected to Evita Perón, and we got in America, you know, the Broadway show Evita and all this other kind of stuff. And so they attach a personality to it, and people get attached to that person, like a celebrity. You know, you got a celebrity politician that everybody wants to follow. And so that's a big part of it as well, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's even more than a celebrity because Evita Perón, you have the cult of personality until today. It became like, let's think this in religious terms. It's like, you know, it's like having saints in the Catholic religion. Mm-hmm. Like, or the cult of Maria Magdalena, for instance.
So she's a patron saint of patron fascism. Saint.
Yeah, it has a religious component. So it's not like, oh, we admire Taylor Swift or whoever it is, and then when she's dead, no one cares. Mm-hmm. This goes way beyond that. They managed to create a very strong, as I said, mythology and with religious fervor. So the people who follow this are fanatics. This is one element that I think we usually tend to underestimate, the importance of ideas, culture, the mentality, no? And now we are seeing this war between Hamas and Israel. You can have a new grasp on the importance of ideology or fundamentalism and ideas. So in Argentina, you have this. And the other problem is that they, Massa and the Peronists, they control the government. Mm-hmm. So they can mobilize lots of resources in order to win the election, to, you know, bribe people to tell them that if Milei wins, they are not going to receive the benefits anymore. This is actually what they did. If you went to the train stations and the bus stations in Argentina, previous to the before the first round, you saw signs that were put up by the government, by Massa, showing people how much the price of the train ticket and the bus ticket would increase in case Milei was elected, or as compared to the price of the transportation tickets if Massa was elected. Wow. And so Milei was like 10 times higher. Mm-hmm. And so they scared people into voting against Milei by telling them that all these subsidies were going to go away, and then they would have to pay much more for transportation, which in a country like Argentina, with a 150% inflation almost, and a ruined economy, it makes a huge difference for people who have to take the train every day to go for work.
Right. And with that kind of inflation, when I reported on it, I said, you know, again, Massa, the guy who is his opponent, the Peronista, is a finance minister. And so he did a big tax cut, and then he gave some new entitlement programs, or an increase in the entitlement programs as well, didn't he? I mean, throwing gasoline on the dumpster fire, right? Didn't he do that as well, besides the propaganda stuff?
Well, yeah, of course. They lower taxes, and also they give a lot of money away so people can, you know, would vote for them. This is a classical assistentialist policy and mentality that we have seen in Latin America, but especially in Argentina for over a century, I would say, even. Mm-hmm. And so there is nothing new there. Now it's very hard for Milei to win, but it's not impossible. I think he has a good chance of winning. And next Sunday, I think it's the election, and the 17th.
Okay. All right. November. And the person who came in third place, who will be moved out, that was Bullrich, a conservative person. Is that correct? You expect that he'll inherit in this three-way race. That conservative vote was being split between Milei and this other person who's now eliminated. Is that correct?
Yeah, Patricia Bullrich came in third place. And she already has endorsed Milei, and also Macri has endorsed Milei. I mean, that doesn't mean that necessarily all of her voters will go and vote for Milei, mm-hmm. Because this the ability of politicians to mobilize the people that supported them has decreased over time. Mm-hmm. So it used to be the case that one politician would say, okay, I support this guy, and many people will follow him, but that's not the case anymore. But a percentage of them will go for Milei, so that's why he still has a chance. And he said they're going to be starting from a clean slate, because there were lots of attacks and aggressions between the two of them during the campaign, and now they are together and trying to win the presidency. Because if they don't do it, then you will have the same cronies and criminals. Basically, there are a bunch of criminals, the people who are running Argentina now. Mm-hmm. Massa even had ties to the narco cartels and things like that. And so they don't have a chance, in my opinion. I mean, if Argentinians really vote again for Peronists in a country where the finance minister has the people living with 140% inflation, mm-hmm. with almost 50% under the poverty line, and where the country is broke and no investments are available, and so on and so forth, then you can only explain this in terms of ideology, and more even so than in terms of, you know, mobilizing resources by the government so that people will vote for you, which mm-hmm. is something they will do anyways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think that's not enough, because people are really suffering now. It's not like they have a lot to lose if they vote for Milei. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, because when in the comments of the after the election, mainstream media here in the United States was going back and looking at comments from people who voted one way or the other. And I don't know if it was just the way that they selected it, if it was truly representative. You've got to try to always try to see through the smoke and the mirrors that the mainstream media is using. But what they were doing, at least in terms of what they were talking about, they said, you know, most of the older people were supporting Massa, I think is his name, the Peronista. And it was mostly young people who were saying, we got to try something different. This just isn't working, who were supporting Javier Milei. Is that kind of similar to what you see there? A generational gap where people that are older maybe are buying into this personality cult, this religion of the Peronistas?
There is a generational gap. There is no doubt that Milei has managed to create a structural change in public opinion in Argentina. That means that younger generations who vote for him, they are not Peronists anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. they are lost to the Peronists. Mm-hmm. And so that is a great achievement. I think it's unbelievable what has been going on there, because this is like converting Muslims into Christians, you know? It's like it's huge. So even if he doesn't win the presidency, I think that is part of his success, and no one can deny that. But of course, in the older generations, the Peronist mythology is much more prevalent, and they tend to embrace it. Stronger in a stronger way than the younger generations, who are also very much worried that they will have no opportunities in this country. And actually, many young people are leaving Argentina to other places. They are mm-hmm. going to the United States or Europe. Many of them have European passports, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I had a girlfriend for a long time who was from Argentina, and all of her family had already left, and many of her friends. We are talking about 20, 25-year-old people, 30-year-old people, because they think there is no hope in this country. Mm-hmm. And the human capital is the first one to leave. And so they all support Milei, mm-hmm. all of them. Mm-hmm. The older guys tend to live a lot from government assistance, you know, the pensions and things like that. And they are still in this mindset. They have still have this mindset of government has to take care of us and give us everything, and Peronism is good, and Massa is the guy. Mm-hmm. But there are also in the, you know, generations, let's say the baby boomers, there are many who vote for Milei because they just are anti-establishment. Mm-hmm. They don't want the same people to be in power anymore, because the corruption scandals and all of that has been completely insane in Argentina over the last years and decades. And so they would vote for Milei just to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. And not that doesn't mean they're really, really classical liberals or people who endorse the free market, but I think they are different type of person. They could vote back for a Peronist that they consider honest in a couple of years from now. Mm-hmm. But so I think if Milei if it was only with people under 30, Milei would have won in the first round. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, the election took place between people above 18, under 30. Milei would have won in the first round. But that tells you something about the future of the country. So I think I'm optimistic in that sense.
I agree. Yeah.
In the medium term, very hard.
Yeah, it is. People who just want to get rid of the corruption that has been so ingrained there. I have a comment from a listener, ALC28, says, pay close attention to the psychological aspect behind the dependent relationship that people have with their government. Many people are afraid of freedom, and they really are. You know, they'd rather have the free stuff than freedom. You know, they will give up their freedom. They think that they can purchase their security and their comfort by giving up their freedom. And of course, Benjamin Franklin said, that's not going to work, never worked. But that is the calculation that they're doing with that. So I think that may be it. But, you know, it's interesting, Axel, the New York Times saw this and said, well, you know, we think that Javier Milei's appealing again to the younger voters who are not attached to the Peronista personas, and they see that it's not working. As you pointed out, they're even leaving the country to try to find economic opportunity that is not there. And so the New York Times says, yeah, but you know, he might have a problem because there might be these Taylor Swift fans who are going to attack him, and they've organized a group called Swifties Against Freedom Advances. And that was, because funny. He's called his, isn't that funny? They don't see the irony of that, I guess, because Freedom Advances is Malay's party. So they're arraying themselves against freedom advancing. They're pretty much self-owned, aren't they, right? But let's talk a little bit about that, because I had an article talking. Obama has come back and has now commented on you know, his disdain that he has for the free market, because he's kind of our peronistas, part of that group. And this headline from Washington Examiner says, Obama warns about the dangers of market-based systems being compatible with slavery. And I'll just read you this two statements that he's sentences that he had here. He says, just because an economic system generated wealth and innovation doesn't mean that it guarantees a good society. He said, market-based systems have been compatible with slavery, caste systems, colonization, war, fraud, autocracy, and the poisoning of our natural environment. And it's like, wow, this guy really does hate free markets. He's not even talking about, you know, capitalism, which some people might attribute to crony capitalism. He's talking about the free market and your ability to have a choice there. It's all about colonization and exploitation and fraud and autocracy. But at the very beginning of it, he says, just because an economic system develops wealth and innovation, well, that's what an economic system is supposed to do, isn't it?
You know, Obama makes a fundamental mistake there, because he's ignorant in economics. I wish he could read my book, Street Economics.
Yes.
So he could learn something. But the fundamental mistake that he makes, and many people on the left make, is, you know, to confuse the free market and something that is, you know, something that exists, like free market institutions, with things that have existed all over, you know, throughout human history.
That's right.
For instance, I mean,
slavery. Slavery, for example. Yeah, the Roman Empire had slavery. They didn't have free markets.
Exactly, and they didn't have a free market. So the right question would be for Obama to ask, where are the places where my ideals, let's assume it's democracy and human rights and, you know, prosperity and social mobility, where are those places that or what you know, characteristic do those places have where you find respect for human rights and you have prosperity and social inclusion and things like that? And the thing that you will find is that all of these places, with no exception, have a market economy. Mm-hmm. There is zero exception to this rule. And now, if you go to places where you have zero market economy or almost no market economy, you will find none of these things that Obama claims to value. So the real question is, what would happen in the absence of the free market, and not if you have, you know, paradise because you have a free market. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of a free market, you wouldn't have prosperity, inclusion, social mobility. You wouldn't have respect for human rights and so on and so forth. And when you have a free market, it's a necessary condition for having a free society that is inclusive. It's not a sufficient condition, but it's a necessary condition. And this is what Obama doesn't understand. And that's why he doesn't value the free market. Mm-hmm. Because, yes, you would have spaces of free market where you have slave trade, for instance. But that doesn't mean that you have the slave trade because you have free markets. You would have the slave trade regardless of the type of economic arrangement that you have in that society. And that's what happened throughout human history.
Yeah.
So
we can look at places like communist China, and we can see that we've got autocracy, we've got fraud, we've got corruption.
Exactly.
We have the poisoning of the natural environment that they have in China. We see that we have all that stuff because of an authoritarian, centrally controlled and planned economy. That is inherent in that system that you have all those.
And that's also another point. It's the same mistake that Pope Francis makes. If you take a look at the countries that respect the environment the most, it's all capitalist free market economies countries. Mm-hmm. It's not the socialist countries. It's not underdeveloped countries. It's not Haiti or, you know, some country in Africa or even the former Soviet Union. It's not what happens. I mean, the Soviet Union was an environmental disaster.
Yes.
It was horrible. People don't know a lot about this, but it was much worse than any Western capitalist country that you could see. And because we have a free market economy, because we have innovation, we can not only provide food and shelter for everyone, but we can improve the technologies so that we can become cleaner and cleaner in the way we produce stuff. And this is what has been going on actually over the last decade. If you take a look at the amount of CO2, for instance, produced per dollar GDP of output, you can see that it has dramatically declined everywhere in the US and even in China. Mm-hmm. But if you take a look at the at soil pollution and water pollution and things like that, air pollution, there's a famous study that was made years ago. I don't remember exactly the date, but it showed that when you surpass $15,000 in per capita income, around that benchmark, mm-hmm. then all these pollutants start to decrease. And so water starts becoming cleaner, air starts getting cleaner, and so on and so forth. So economic development, thanks to free market economies, make the world cleaner in the end. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can always say, well, you know, if we went back to the Stone Age when we wouldn't have any poisoning of the air and things like that, which is also not entirely true, because back then we had some volcanic eruptions that were much worse than anything we have ever seen. Yeah. So, but that's not reasonable to argue, you know, mm-hmm. and that's the problem mm-hmm. with the extinctionists nowadays. They say, oh, humans are a plague. We have to, more or less, everyone has to die. Mm-hmm. Not us, but everyone else has to die so that the earth, you know, will be clean and pure again, which is an anti-humanist and genocidal way of thinking. Yes. I'm not saying Obama thinks like that, but he's very confused when it comes to the free market. It's like saying, well, democracy is also compatible with corruption. It's also compatible with human rights violations. It's also compatible with, you know, all sorts of evil stuff, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that it is because you have democracy that you have that. It's sure. when you have democracy, a liberal democracy especially, that respects fundamental rights, where you have less of this sort of evils in general, as a general rule. You have exceptions, of course.
Yes.
And so he wouldn't say that when he if he was speaking about democracy, but because he hates the free market or because he doesn't like it, he just cannot think clearly about it.
That's right. Yeah. Cause and effect, you know, what actually caused it, or is this something that was there before and after? Again, the book is The Street Economist, Axel Kaiser, 15 Economic Lessons Every Citizen Should Know. And Obama should know these too, but he doesn't. So, you know, and you got to say, look, this centrally controlled economies work really well for people like Xi and China and Obama. You know, he's done really well in terms of trying to plan economies and other people's lives and take away their choices. But talk a little bit about one of the lessons that you got in there. You say only two ways to make a living, from your own work or from somebody else's work. And I guess you would say that Obama and the Peronistas are making their living from somebody yep. else's work, right?
So, yeah, you know, this is a very fundamental lesson and a very deep thing. If you really think about this, when we were in paradise and all you forms of utopianism, you know, offer a place where you will not have to work or you will not have to put so much effort in order to, you know, provide for your life and your mm-hmm. family's life. And so socialists and collectivists and people like Obama tend to believe that is a moral value when you don't have to really put your own effort into achieving something like providing for yourself. They think it's the responsibility of the community, of society, to make sure that everyone has enough to survive. And when they do this, they basically promote policies that destroy incentives so that people can create wealth, and they create incentives. And you see this in Argentina, of course, and also in the US, to a different extent, that people will live at the expense of someone else. Because, as I say in the book, you have only two ways of supporting your life. You can work for yourself and provide for yourself, or you can live out of someone else. Mm-hmm. Someone else pays your bills, basically. That's what we do as parents. We pay our kids' bills. Why? Because they are children. They cannot provide for themselves. It's a natural order of things, mm-hmm. right? But when you are an adult and you are not providing for, unless you are ill and you have some sort of different problem, and you are not providing for yourself, someone else has to provide for yourself. And this is the promise that is offered by the left worldwide, that you will not have to worry because someone else has your back. They will pay for your bills. It's of course not the politicians who promise this, that take their money from their pockets in order to pay for them. It's through the tax system, your neighbor or someone who is rich or has a better situation than you, and you will take away from him and will give it to you. Mm-hmm. Because to some extent, they feel that it is unfair that some people have more than others, and they feel it is also unfair to have to work for making a living. It's a fundamental problem that you have with this mindset, which is the utopianism behind it. It's the idea that life is unfair because you have to work in order to make a living. Mm-hmm. And if we just were in the perfect place in paradise again, we wouldn't have to work. And they are trying to offer that. They're trying to tell people, you know, don't worry, this time is not God who is going to provide for everything in paradise. This time it's the state, it's the mm-hmm. government. Mm-hmm. It's us in charge of the government.
It's God-verment. God-verment. It's like I call them. And we had this in spades, didn't we, with the lockdowns? And I don't know what they did in South America, but, you know, we had the lockdowns, and then they gave people stimulus checks. Don't work, stay home, I'll give you this money. And that was training for universal basic income. Is that something that's being pushed by... I'm sure it is. It's a globalist agenda. I'm sure it's being pushed in South America, yeah, for sure. The universal basic income. We've even got former economists that, like Charles Murray, that I really respected, when he talked about how a welfare state had actually harmed the people it was supposed to help and made them dependent on the state. And now he's pushing universal basic income. It's truly amazing to see how this is being pushed. But it also, I think it's amazing, Axel, how quickly people caught on to that. And how quickly they became dependent on it, saw that as an entitlement, and I shouldn't have to go to work. I want to stay home and continue to collect my check and so forth, and stimulus check, not even working from home with a Zoom, but I want to stay home and get that stimulus check. It worked really well.
Yeah, that is a big trend nowadays to argue for UBI, especially because of all the technological innovation that is coming, and the argument that it will replace jobs and destroy jobs, and machines are going to do everything in the end. Actually, Elon Musk recently had an interview, I don't know if you saw this, with the Prime Minister of the UK, and he said that he believed that all jobs were going to be destroyed by AI, all of them. No exception, mm-hmm. basically, and that we wouldn't have a UBI, but we would have a universal high income or something like that, he called it, because we would have so much resources, that so much money in the end, that we would be able to provide everything you wanted for everyone, and no one will have to work unless you wanted to. Well, this sounds like a point in time where you don't have the economic problem anymore, which is how to provide, and to get the resources. But I don't like the UBI because they are, first of all, they are arguing for the UBI on top of all the welfare measures that we already have. It's not like we are going to shut down the welfare state and we are going to give a UBI to people who cannot, you know, reach a certain amount of money so that they can support themselves. It's apart from everything the government is already doing. They want to introduce the UBI, which I think is horrible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even if you got rid of all the welfare state and you had a very small government, which would be much better for everyone, the problem with the UBI is what you just said. You make people dependent on these handouts. And this has not only, of course, you solve the economic problem of the resources that you need for eating and shelter and all that, but you have another element that you have to take into account. People need to find meaning in life, and they need to feel useful members of society. And there is no better way to achieve that than through work. And so if you have people depending on government, and money that is being just given to them, their sense of dignity, of self-worth, is going to dramatically plummet. And we have seen this in welfare states all over the world. Even in countries like Sweden or Denmark, you have that problem. And then you will have a social crisis, and you know, probably this disenfranchised people that will go on streets burning cars, like you see in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
All
mm-hmm.
these migrants that you see destroying things in Europe are on welfare, all of them.
Yes.
Most of them are young men who are not even working.
And they don't have any direction. You know, I when I looked at asymmetric warfare centers here in the U.S., and you had these military people who were analyzing what was happening in these other countries, they said, you know, the thing that's motivating them is not Islam or any kind of radical religion. What motivates them? These are typically, the profile is typically somebody who's in their 30s. They're well-educated. They might have been an engineer or something like that. But now they see that they have no control over their future because, you know, we've come in and bombed their country and we're occupying it. So they see that they have no control over the future, and that helplessness radicalizes yeah. them, turns them into terrorists. Then they turn to religion, but they're radicalized by having absolutely no control or purpose in their life that's been taken away from them. And so when you look at the people that are being brought in with the open borders into Europe and into the United States, we know that they're bringing them in. It's going to develop into a sense of hopelessness and frustration. They want them to be radicalized in that. But, you know, when we look at what the we look at what the technocrats are doing, George Gilder said these Silicon Valley people, he called them neo-Marxist, Axel. And he said the reason he called them neo-Marxist, he said they've got a fundamental conceit like Karl Marx that who said we have with the Industrial Revolution, we've got we can make more physical goods than we ever need. And now we just have to figure out how we're going to distribute those, and we'll let the government do it. And so George Gilder said, that's what the Silicon Valley people are saying. They say, we got all this technology, we got genetics, robotics, artificial intelligence, nanotech. All we have to do is just figure out, we have infinite physical goods, we just need to put it out there. It sounds like that's what Elon Musk is telling Rishi Sunak. What do you think about that? Does that sound like Marxism to you?
Well, you know, the problem with Marxism promised something like having a utopia where no one will have to, where there will be freedom from want, right?
Yeah, like, freedom from want, exactly. That's what, in terms with their of technology, freedom. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that machines would do everything and would create all of the prosperity for us. That this is the mindset right now. Mm-hmm. In Marx's utopia, it would be the communist society that would create all of this wealth. He didn't really detail how this was going to happen, of course.
Because a lot of hand waving going on there.
Yeah, he was selling the dream, you know, and of course, I mean, I have the thesis that Marx knew very well that he wanted to create dictatorships and destroy the existing order and send, you know, millions of people to their death. And the way that he had to... The way he sold this was by saying, at some point we are going to be so happy and no one will need to work much more than he will have to in order to provide for himself and his family, and we will be so wealthy, everyone will have so much from everything.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. that part of the story is similar to what Marx envisioned. Now, I think there are other utopias, not only Marxism, that had promised something like this. This is why I, in my view, the idea of paradise is so powerful, because almost all sorts of utopias, not all of them, but offer something like a paradise on earth where people will live, you know, in security, and you will not have this existential fear that you will not be able to find food, or I mean resources to provide for yourself and your family. And so I think in Silicon Valley right now, you are seeing this form of utopia.
Mm-hmm.
Only there are better reasons now to believe that this could happen, actually, because if it is really true that general artificial intelligence can surpass human beings in everything we do, and produce limitless resources, more or less, then yes, at some point you will have superabundance and the economic problem will be over. I don't think this is going to happen, but mm-hmm, if it's mm-hmm. true.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when we had Michael Bloomberg running for president in the 2020 cycle briefly. He made a statement that a lot of people got very angry with him because he denigrated farmers' contributions. Said, they're stupid. Anybody can do that job. People said, no, it's a complicated job. You got a lot of different things that you got to manage. You're an entrepreneur. You're taking risks. You got to be able to fix equipment, all this kind of. And then, but what he was saying in the context, Axel, was he was saying, well, we had the agrarian revolution, a culture, and then we replaced it with an industrial culture, industrial society. And he said, so, you know, those people who were working on the farm, they went, worked in the factory, but he goes, now those of us who are smart can replace all of them. And we're working on how we take everybody's jobs. And he said, we have to figure out how we're going to keep them after we take their jobs, how we keep them from coming after us with guillotines. That was what he said. And so that's exactly the way I see this UBI. Yeah. You know, these people sell us these utopias that you're talking about. And how we're going to have everything is going to be handed to us on a silver platter. You know, the artificial intelligence is going to do this, says the world's richest man. And then he's just going to share that wealth with you. And yet the reality is that it's really more of a pacification. And it kind of reminds me of what H.G. Wells did with the time machine. You know, he goes forward in the future and he sees little pink creatures that they have everything provided for them, it seems like. And they call them the Eloi. And then at night, the Morlocks come out from underneath the ground and harvest which ones of those they want to eat.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really what I think is in the mindset of these billionaire technocrats who are telling us about this utopia that's on its way. I think they're setting us up to be Eloi.
Well, you know, I think in the case of Elon Musk, maybe he's even worried about this. He didn't say this when he was speaking with Sunak, but he doesn't seem to be like one of these hardcore ideologues in that sense. And he's very worried about artificial intelligence going wrong and you know, maybe becoming a threat to humanity. But he believes strongly that we will come to a point where the machines and artificial intelligence can provide for everything. So you will have your personal trainer will be some sort of robot, and you will have your psychologist will be some AI that knows you better than yourself and things like that. But we have to think about what it means to be human. Because now we're entering an age where this is going to be the defining on the most challenging question. And if we get it wrong, I think we are heading to collapse and to widespread chaos in the world. Even if we have AI producing, or because we have AI producing all of this free stuff. So yes, there is some element of that. What you are saying is like, okay, we are the rich guys. We are going to give you the crumbs of everything we are producing so that you are not, you know, coming after us and creating a revolution. But you could have this revolution anyways, because if you are on UBI and you used to work as a lawyer or you used to work as whatever, white, blue collar works, and you are on UBI and you have the other very smart people who are running the show, you will have a caste system,
yes,
basically.
Yes, yes.
And that is very, I would say, incompatible with human nature and the way we humans work.
I agree. And I think that caste system, I think that caste system is a technocracy, you know?
Exactly. And so we will feel like we are not even the slaves, because there was something that you could say, at least if you were slave, you were forced to work for someone. And you could always think, I mean, I could be free someday, or I could, you know, or this is an abuse that is being committed against me. But if you are on UBI, you don't even have that. Mm-hmm. It's like you are just some sort of a dependent, like an infant, and these very bright people are feeding you and are giving you stuff so that, you know, you are just remaining peaceful and not bothering them too much.
That's right. Yeah. And they've been very obvious about the fact that's what they want to do. Yuval Harari says, yeah, the future doesn't need you. We just need to find a way that we can pacify you. Maybe we can do it with entertainment until you guys just kind of breed yourself out of existence or whatever, or we find some way to quietly kill you. I mean, it's very sinister when you look at it, the big design that they have. And that's why, you know, when you look at that's what I like about your book. You talk about real tangible issues and how economics is at the center of what we do in terms of helping us, giving us a mission, part of our humanity, how entrepreneurs are social benefactors, and not just doing it for their own good, but society in general benefits from that. You take away all that. You take away the entrepreneurship. You take away the pride of being able to create something. That's really destroying us at our core of humanity, isn't it?
Exactly. Let's go and tell you know, painters and artists and people who work agricultures who really love what they do, or at least they feel like they are needed, you know, because otherwise society doesn't work. And we all do things that other people value. That's why we get some income. Mm-hmm. And now you will tell them, we don't need you. Like, you are completely not only replaceable, but your existence doesn't matter to anyone.
Yes.
In terms of collaboration and in terms of, you know, this is a very hard appeal to swallow. I don't believe that this is going to work. I don't believe this is going to end well if AI starts producing everything, and you know, no psychologist will have a job, no doctor will have a job, because AI will do everything. No architect, no nothing. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do all day? Watch movies with fake actors that are being played by AI?
Yeah.
I mean, what are we going to do?
Music that's done by AI and recycling other people that have been around there. It is crazy. And yet, you know, this is kind of, again, what is the fatal conceit of all these utopian societies? Is that somebody that's designing the society knows how to run everything, that they've somehow got godlike intelligence and they know how to run it. And so now what they've done is they've moved this away to try to make this feasible to people, since they've run that into the ground. Oh, but we'll create artificial intelligence that has godlike intelligence, and it will tell you what to do. It is, there's a...
Yes.
I tell you what, you know, my spidey senses are going off, you know, when I hear this kind of stuff happening all the time.
Yeah, more than utopia, we are going to get dystopia. We are going to have a lot of, you know, more along the lines of Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. We will have like a totalitarian technocratic society where, you know, we're going to be just like cogs in the machine, and then they're going to tell us, not even that, because we will not even be part of the machine. Maybe we will feed the machine, like in Matrix, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's all what's going to be left for us. I mean, it's very hard to really foresee what's going to happen, but I could not imagine having, you know, hundreds of millions of people unemployed with nothing to do, being peaceful and just happy, you know, meditating the whole day. This is not going to happen.
I agree. Yeah, and Jason Barker. Let me give you this comment from one of our listeners. And of course, he's also got a broadcast. He says, Knights of the Storm, as well as the Foxhole Report. Jason Barker says the new caste system they want is about removing hope. There is no mechanism to get out. And that's why the 15-minute cities and the death of private transportation. Do you agree with that? I mean, that, to me, that sounds spot on. I think that's exactly.
I agree with, if you lose hope, you lose everything.
Yes.
And you cannot have hope where you yourselves are not, you cannot envision a way in which you can to somehow fulfill a potential that you have. And that potential that you can fulfill or develop needs from others and needs the case. I mean, you have to be able to make the case that you are useful to others and that other people will value you for what you are capable of offering as a human being in different aspects of life. And yes, of course, people can tell you, but you will still be able to love, to have children and your family, and this is important. Of course, that's all very important. I hope that AI doesn't replace that, because now you will have like AI girlfriends that will look robots, like all in these movies, and they look like humans, and they are pretty, and you know. So even that, it's going to change if this continues to develop in that direction. But I think we will live in a hopeless society, and when you have that, you have the perfect, you know, ferment for a social explosion and a revolution.
That's right.
Because someone will come and say enough, and they will try offer you some sort of hope. And if you take a look at the Nazis, it's exactly what Hitler did with the German people that were completely despaired desperation because they were, you know, hyperinflation, depression, and they had no hope. Then you had this guy. You had the same thing in the Russian Revolution. And the same thing in the French Revolution, the great, the three great revolutions we've had and genocidal revolutions we had in the last, in modern times. Why wouldn't that be the case now in an age of superabundance? It could be the case.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
It could happen.
Yes. Yes. Because again, you know, life is more than just about what we own. And, but these are existential questions, really, that you give very simple answers to. In terms of, and I say existential issues because this is, these are, it's a thin book, it's easy to read, and it is a way for you to try to explain to people who have been deceived into what this is about. Why these utopian systems, why these centrally controlled systems really don't work, and why it's doomed to failure, why it is doomed to despair. And so this is a great way that this book, you do a great job, Axel, of distilling these arguments, giving real world examples that people, if you look at this, you can explain it to your children, you can explain it to your friends if they are hearing this siren song of free stuff forever, and they're going to keep us safe if we just surrender everything to them. Thank you so much for joining us, and very interesting. We'll be watching again. You said the Argentina election is what, about 2 weeks away or so?
Yeah, it's 17, November 17th. So I think it's
10 days.
Is it next week? Yeah, it's almost, yeah.
Okay, on the weekend. Yeah. Okay, we'll be looking and keeping our fingers crossed that things will work out better for the people in Argentina, that they can take a step back towards reality and away from hyperinflation and authoritarian socialist policies. Thank you for all the work that you do, and thank you for this excellent book, The Street Economist by Axel Kaiser. Thank you very much, Axel. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for
having me. All right, folks, we're going to be coming right back. Stay with us. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about what's happening with banks still happening in the United States. We're still having some problems with the processing stuff, as well as some updates on the pharmaceutical industry and its machinations about controlling us. We'll be right back.
Using free speech to free minds. It's the David Knight Show.